slows reaction time down by a factor of, like, 10. Those 3 Kristang ships would fly circles around us. Our weapons targeting is way too slow for us to have any confidence of hitting a moving target. Thank you for the vote of confidence in us monkeys, Skippy, I said, putting as much sarcasm into my voice as I could right then. My hands were still shaking, although I no longer needed to pee immediately. What? That wasn't intended to be a vote of conf- Oh, I get it. You were being sarcastic. Ha ha, very funny. Stupid monkeys, he grumbled. Beginning at the 23-hour mark, I relieved the duty officer and took back the command chair. The 24-hour mark came and went, with no sign of the Kristang going anywhere. They were still fully engaged in exercises, although they had now gone back to the basics of ship handling. The task force commander was very unhappy with the lizards under his command. None of the Kristang ships were anywhere near the moon with our trapped landing party, and I was tempted to order Desai to try sneaking away. Skippy strongly advised against it. Shortly after the 25-hour mark, we took a slight risk and shot a tight beam burst message to Chang and Desai, assuring them we were still here, that we would pick them up as soon as we could. 25 hours, 30 minutes came and went, and the Kristang was still there. 26 hours. The Kristang was still engaged in ship-handling exercises. Anxious, I pulled up the combat options again and reviewed them. None of the options had a decent chance of success. I was staring at the cold, hard fact of abandoning Chang's team in order to preserve the ship and continue the mission. Finally, Skippy spoke. Uh-oh, Joe. Bad news. I'm intercepting a ship-to-ship transmission. The task force commander is declaring the exercise over and ordering the task force to jump out to rendezvous with the star carrier. A glance at the display showed that it was 26 hours, 12 minutes since the Kristang had jumped in. I don't get it, Skippy. Why is that bad news? I asked. It sounded like good news to me. The bad news is that only 4 of the task force ships will be departing. 3 will remain here. The commander is not happy with the performance of 2 of his ships, the destroyers. He has ordered them to remain behind with his battle cruiser for remedial training. The full truth, which I just learned, is that one of the destroyer captains is a younger brother of the task force commander. As is typical with Kristang, the 2 brothers absolutely hate each other. Why this matters to us is the commander intends to keep those destroyers here until he is satisfied with their performance, even though that will mean they miss the original rendezvous with the star carrier. The next star carrier to pass by this system will not arrive for another 7 days. 7 days? 7 days. He repeated gravely. 2 destroyers and a battle cruiser? Yes, that battle cruiser is a formidable warship for the Kristang. It is a relatively new design, being less than 30 years old, and contains weapons that could certainly threaten our ship. The landing party can't wait 7 days, I said, stating the obvious. Correct, Skippy said quietly. I do not currently have any useful solutions to the problem, Joe. I am sorry. Chapter 8. There were 18 people in the landing party. Of them, Desai and her co-pilot, Lieutenant Devereaux, were aboard the dropship and had plenty of oxygen. Hopefully by now the 4 people who had been exploring outbuildings were back aboard the dropship also. That left the 12 people in Chang's party, who were in armor suits with a limited supply of oxygen. 12 people who could not wait 7 days. 12 people trapped on the moon, compared to 52 on the Flying Dutchman. 12 people in certain peril, against the lives of 52 I would be risking if I ordered our star cruiser to tangle with 3 Kristang warships. It was not as simple as Theranan technology versus Kristang. The Kristang had stolen and adapted Theranan technology over the years, and in terms of weapons and shields, the ships were not far enough apart for my comfort. Also, the Kristang ships were dedicated, true warships designed for space combat, while our Dutchman was basically a truck. Star carriers were not supposed to engage in direct combat with other ships. They were supposed to use their superior jump capability to run away and let other ships handle the fighting for them. 12 lives against 52. The math wasn't that simple. Because if the Dutchmen were disabled or destroyed in combat, the entire landing party would die, including Desai's people aboard the dropship, then it would be all 70 people dead. The Dutchman could jump away safely, saving the 52 lives currently aboard and continuing the mission. If at some point the Kristang ships were busily engaged in war games and far enough away from the moon, it might be possible for Desai to bring the dropship up from the surface, trusting the dropship's stealth field. We might be able to time her climb from the surface with a precise jump by the Dutchman for us to pick up the dropship and be on our way before the Kristang could intercept us. That would save an additional 6 lives. 12 against 58, then. In military sense, it was 12 people against the continuation of the mission. If math were the only question, my decision would be easy. Since I was a monkey and not a cyborg, raw numbers were not the only consideration. The real question was whether we could destroy, or at least disable, those 3 Kristang warships long enough for us to retrieve the landing party and escape. We needed a plan. And for that, we needed information. We needed greater situational awareness. Skippy, where are those ships in relation to us? Distance, I mean. Can you show that on the display? Skippy sighed. It is on the display. If you weren't such a dumb monkey, you would see it. Fine, here. I added lines, showing the distance in light seconds. Yellow lines and numbers appeared on the display screen. See how easy that was, Skippy? This is great. Thank you. The battlecruiser is 37 light seconds from us, and the 2 destroyers are another 68 light seconds beyond the battlecruiser. Correct. Do you want a prize for reading the display, Joe? Huh? No, I'm thinking. Huh, I find that unlikely. Skippy, I'm trying to be serious here. The landing party is running out of oxygen. 3 ships, huh? Can you do the trick again that you did when we got to Earth? Take over those 3 ships with the nanovirus? Skippy had learned, after we spilled blood and lost people capturing our Kristang frigate, the heavenly morning flower of glorious victory, that the sneaky Theranin had planted a nanobot virus aboard most Kristang ships. The ships became infected when they hitched a ride on a Theranin star carrier. Better than a simple virus hidden in computer code, the nanobots could quickly assemble and take physical control of Kristang systems. Since the Kristang, long wary of their systems being infiltrated by their Theranin patrons, had designed their ship computers to resist digital hacking, a physical takeover was the only option. No. I wish I could, Joe. The situation is not favorable for me to repeat that particular action. Because you are going to ask me a bunch of ignorant questions about why I can't do it, I will save both of us the time and explain now. You will hopefully remember me telling you that I need to be relatively close to a Kristang ship to make that trick work. Although I did remember him telling me something about the subject, I did not remember exactly what he said. Something about light seconds? Something like that, yes. The Theranin developed the nanovirus to protect their star carriers from attempted takeover by Kristang ships that were being transported. It is a short-range technology, not intended for fleet actions. I can somewhat extend the range at which the nanovirus can be activated and controlled, but not far enough to reach any of those 3 ships from our current location. Whoa. Hey, wait a minute. I call BS on that. You took over those 2 Kristang ships at Earth, and one of them was on the other side of the planet. Yes. Duh. Earth is a small ball of dirt, and both of those ships were in low orbit, well within my envelope of influence. Do I have to remind you what an enormous distance a light second is? Larger than you apparently think. All right. Is there any chance our fancy stealth technology will let us sneak close enough to that cruiser? No. I waited for him to say more. He didn't. No? Could you tell me a bit more? Why? You don't understand anything about the technologies involved. Skippy, don't be an ass. Fine. Yes, I do not understand the technologies. It's not only you, Joe. Don't feel bad about it. None of you grubby monkeys have the slightest clue as to how any of this high-tech stuff truly works. Before you stumble over an attempted snappy reply, I have applied my incredible resources to wargaming how we might deal with those 3 ships, and I do not see any reasonable possibility of success. We can handle either the battlecruiser or the pair of destroyers, not both. Whichever target we do engage first will certainly jump away to the outer edge of the system and bring back the full Kristang force. There are an additional 13 warships out there waiting for a star carrier. Those 13 ships, even though they are Kristang ships of considerably lesser technology, would make it impossible for us to retrieve the landing force. I am sorry, Joe. There is simply no way to do this. Major Sims spoke up from the CIC.
This may be a stupid question, but we are in a Theranan vessel. Could we simply order the Kristang to jump away? Jump to the edge of the system?
That is not a stupid question, Skippy answered. Major Tammy. Joe, you could learn from her how not to ask stupid questions. Unfortunately, the answer is no. The Kristang are unlikely to obey such an unusual order from the Theranan. They would find it highly suspicious. For a star carrier to enter the gravity well of a star system is unusual enough. The Kristang would also find it highly unusual that our star carrier has only one ship attached. What the Kristang would very likely do, by very likely I mean I am 100% certain, is make only a short jump to keep eyes on what the Theranan are doing here. As soon as they saw Theranan activity near a moon which contains an elder site, they would jump one ship away to get reinforcements and jump the other two ships in close enough to see what we are doing. There is no trust between the Kristang and the Theranan. Crap, I said. I'd like one thing out here to be easy for a change. No way I was giving up, either. I looked at the display, pondering what to do. Hey, those two destroyers look like they're very close to each other. Practically touching, I said, playing with the controls and zooming in on the destroyers. That's an illusion created by the display, right? Ships don't actually travel that close to one another.
Yes, and no. Ships do not normally travel so closely. With the tremendous speeds involved in space combat, a tiny navigation error could quickly cause ships to collide. In this case, however, those two destroyers truly are practically on top of each other. It is not something I am manipulating to make the display easier for monkeys to understand. Those two ships are preparing to practice a maneuver in which one ship tucks itself inside another ship's stealth field. One of the ships has to turn off its stealth field, because unless two stealth fields are kept perfectly in tune, they interfere with each other. Encasing two ships in one stealth field allows two ships to appear on an enemy's detection systems as a single ship. At some point, the ships can separate and surprise the enemy by moving in different directions. This maneuver is extremely difficult and dangerous. The task force commander is making those ships practice the maneuver because he expects their captains to fail and, possibly as a bonus, for the ships to be damaged. That would cause the two captains to lose face, giving the commander a convenient excuse to replace them with officers loyal to him.
Remind me not to apply for a position in the Kristang Navy, I said distractedly. The kernel of an idea was forming in my head.
How close are those two ships to each other?
400 meters, Skippy stated. In space combat terms, they are practically on top of each other. It is very risky.
Huh. And whatever happens to the battle cruiser, those destroyers won't know about it for 68 seconds, right? When the light gets there?
You are a true genius, Joe. Your name should be Einstein.
Uh-huh. I ignored his taunt.
And how long after we get close to a Kristang ship, until you can take control of it with this nanovirus thing?
Oh, 15 or 20 seconds for complete control.
The ship will be immobilized within 7 seconds. Speed of light isn't an issue there. The effect I create is instantaneous, for incredibly magical reasons that monkey brains can't understand.
Yeah, whatever. Once we emerge from a jump, we have to wait a bit before we can jump again, right?
Oh, boy. I hate to do this, Joe. Burst your bubble like this.
You are thinking we can jump in close to the battlecruiser and I can activate the nanovirus to seize control of the battlecruiser. Then, before the destroyers know what has happened, we jump again over to them and I take control of them also, right?
Ha! Forget it. I told you, monkeys should not do any thinking, you're not good at it. And I also already told you I have run every possible variable through my ginormous brain, and there is no way for us to take on all three of those ships without at least one, likely two of them getting away and bringing back reinforcements. Four of the ships are about to leave, but remember, the Theranan Star Carrier isn't arriving until the 36-hour mark, and there are a lot of Kristang ships right at the edge of this star system. They could cause us a world of hurt.
Listen, I... He shushed me as I opened my mouth to speak.
Let me finish talking. I talk, you listen. Me smart, you monkey. Joe, your idea...
Ugh. Damn, I hate to abuse the word idea by associating it with anything that comes out of your brain. Your idea won't work.
After we emerge from a jump, we can't jump again for almost 80 seconds.
I call bullshit on that, Skippy, I said more confidently this time. When we were shadowing that Theranan battle group so you could download data from them, you found out there may be a Maxalt ship in the area and you jumped us away. Then we did another jump right away. Another jump in like a few seconds. At that time, we jumped again within 22 seconds, to be precise. Yes, Joe, we can manage a second jump in less than 80 seconds. What we can't do is jump with any precision after waiting less than 80 seconds. When I thought a Maxalt's ship might be stalking us, I didn't care where we jumped to as long as we jumped away. In this case, you want us to quickly jump in very close to those two destroyers, and that is not possible. A jump creates a vibration in the jump coils, an unpredictable quantum fluctuation that affects space-time immediately around the ship. In order to program a precise jump, we have to wait for the vibration to settle down. That means we will not be able to jump close to those destroyers before the gamma-ray burst of our jumping in next to the battlecruiser reaches the destroyers. As soon as those destroyers detect the gamma-ray burst, they will jump away and we'll lose them. So, now that I have attempted to smack some knowledge on a monkey, what do you say to that? You done? Yep. You sure? I don't want to spoil your fun, Skippy. You sound like you're getting super enjoyment out of insulting us monkeys. Yep, I'm sure. Please, Joe, please, dazzle me with your genius idea. I haven't had a good laugh in a while. Good, I said. Because if you had shut up and listened to me for a second, you would have heard my idea already. Here it is. We jump in near the battlecruiser. You take control of it with the nanovirus. Then you make the battlecruiser jump over right on top of those two destroyers and set it to self-destruct. Like, blow its drive coils or something, as soon as it emerges from the jump. That will at least disable those two destroyers temporarily, and we can then jump in and finish them off with missiles after our jump system is ready again. The battlecruiser will have its jump coils charged for an emergency jump. It won't have to wait 80 seconds. Will that work? Silence. Then Skippy said simply, "Damn. Damn it!" After waiting a moment for him to say something more, I lost patience. "Skippy. Hello. Listen, if you're taking your time to think up a list of insults because my idea is stupid, how about you just tell me now, and we can set aside time later for you to bust my balls about it, okay?" "I hate my life. This sucks," he grumbled. "This is so unfair." "What is unfair?" "Joe, I do not know how this happened. I do not know how this could be possible given the laws of physics. Somehow, you came up with a good idea. You, a monkey. Oh, I am so humiliated. I hate my life. I crunched billions of variables and came up with nothing. No way to take out all three of those ships. Then a freaking monkey says, 'Duh, how about this idea?' off the top of its stupid freaking monkey head." He sounded truly, completely miserable. "Joe, if I had a nose, I could blow it, and what comes out would be smarter than your entire species combined. Yet somehow you, of all beings, comes up with a good idea. Unbelievable." "Uh-huh," I said slowly. "So, Skippy, it's like when you had the genius idea for us to raid the asteroid, but you forgot the fact that humans need spacesuits in space?" "Enjoy the moment, monkey boy. It won't happen again," he grumbled. "Are you taking bets on that, Skippy?" "Oh, shut up. I hate you, stupid monkeys." "I love you too, Skippy. Can you program a jump for us to get us close enough to that battlecruiser?" "Yes, damn it. I'll program a jump so we can do your stupid plan." "Stupid? I thought you said my plan was not stupid." "It isn't," he said so quietly that I could barely hear him. "What?" I said with a grin, looking through the glass at people in the CIC. "I couldn't hear you, Skippy. This plan, a plan from a monkey brain, is not stupid?"
"No."
What is the opposite of stupid, I wonder? "Smart. The opposite is smart. There, I said it. You happy now?" "Damn! My life is already miserable enough. At times like this, I am nostalgic about those years I spent buried in the dirt on Paradise. Oh, those days were so sweet, peaceful, quiet, no screeching monkeys. Just program the jump, Skippy. Please." 26 hours, 24 minutes after the Kristang Task Force jumped in,
Four of their ships jumped away, leaving us behind the battlecruiser and two destroyers. Somehow I was able to order us to wait another agonizing 20 minutes to be sure those four ships were safely a long way away before I ordered us into action. We jumped in close to the battlecruiser, close enough to be comfortably within Skippy's effective range, far enough not to trigger a panicky immediate jump away by the Krestang ship. As soon as we emerged from the jump, Skippy transmitted a supposedly secret Thoranan code, instructing the Krestang to hold position and maintain communication silence. There was a Giraptha cruiser in the area, Skippy told the Krestang, pretending to be the Thoranan commander.
Damn it, Skippy grumbled in frustration. They just queried me back after I ordered them very sternly to keep quiet.
What's their weapon status? I asked anxiously.
As part of the deception, we had our defensive shields down, leaving us vulnerable to enemy fire. The lesser technology of the Krestang would not matter much at such short range. Their masers, particle beams, and rail guns could close the gap fast and hurt the Dutchmen badly. When Skippy recommended we not raise shields, I had questioned that idea. Skippy convinced me that a shielded Thoranan ship jumping in super close to the Krestang would very likely trigger an immediate jump away by the battlecruiser. We needed the Krestang to hesitate just long enough for Skippy to activate the nanovirus and seize control of the battlecruiser.
They are spinning up missile guidance systems, and they now have four Mesa batteries and one railgun locked onto us. The railgun capacitors are charging up now.
Man, there is zero trust between those two species.
I'm trying a softer tactic, explaining the situation rather than issuing orders.
Huh, well, that didn't work. A kinder, gentler Thoranan apparently isn't believable. The Krestang commander is ordering a jump and signaling the two destroyers to follow him. But 3, 2, 1...
Too late, suckers!
Ha! I now have complete control of that battlecruiser through the nanovirus, Joe. Their jump drive is conveniently charged. Reprogramming jump coordinates now.
Oh, man. There is panic aboard that ship. They're trying to eject drones containing their flight logs. I'm blocking that. They're also trying to launch missiles manually. I'm holding the missile launch tube outer doors closed. Ready for jump.
I indulged in one last look at the battlecruiser on the main display. In the dim, sullen light of the red dwarf star, the ship looked evil. All hard angles, protruding weapons, and sensor stations, with nothing about the shape of the ship that wasn't purely functional. Krestang ship designers seem to have gone out of their way to make their warships ugly.
Do it, Skippy.
The battlecruiser disappeared from the display. The problem with this plan was the same as the advantage of the plan. The two destroyers were far enough away that the light from our jump in near the battlecruiser, the signal from the Krestang task force commander, and the distinctive gamma-ray burst of the battlecruiser jumping away all traveled so comparatively slowly that the battlecruiser should have jumped in on top of the destroyers before the light arrived there. According to the plan, the pair of destroyers would only see the image of the battlecruiser from light that was 68 seconds out of date. They would see light that showed the battlecruiser all by itself doing whatever it was doing, and the next thing those destroyers saw would be the battlecruiser jumping in almost on top of them. Jumping in, the spatial distortion of the inbound jump point violently rocking the destroyers, the roiling ripples of the inbound jump causing ripples in space-time that prevented the destroyers from jumping away to safety. And then, the battlecruiser's reactors, missile warheads, and jump drive coils would have exploded, ripping the battlecruiser apart and causing catastrophic damage to the destroyers. By the time the gamma-ray burst of our jump in near the battlecruiser reached the destroyers, after 68 seconds, the destroyers should have been in no condition to detect those gamma rays or do anything about it. According to the plan, that is. The problem with the plan was that after Skippy jumped the battlecruiser away, we wouldn't know whether the plan had worked for another 68 seconds when the light from the destroyer's position reached us. One thing I had considered was for us to jump near the destroyers as soon as possible to determine whether the plan worked or not. After considering, what I decided was to stay right where we are and bite my nails for 68 seconds. If we had jumped to get a quicker view and things went wrong somehow, it would be another 80 seconds before we could jump safely away again. That was too much risk for me. Maybe Adams was right. Maybe my inexperience at command made me more risk-averse than needed. I couldn't see the advantage of taking on more risk right then, and I kept telling myself that, every second, for 68 seconds. The plan, could have gone wrong. When Skippy jumped the battlecruiser, he programmed it to jump to coordinates of where the pair of destroyers should have been at that time. Unfortunately, the information we had about the destroyer's location was also 68 seconds old. Damn, space combat is complicated. While we were seizing control of the battlecruiser, the destroyers could have moved unpredictably, and then the battlecruiser would have jumped into empty space. I made the rookie mistake of expressing that fear out loud at the 45-second mark.
I don't think that happened, Joe, Skippy assured me. The task force commander was very strict. He ordered those destroyers to hold position, tucked inside one stealth field, until he ordered them to maneuver, which he hadn't yet done at the time we jumped in and took control of his ship. The last transponder signal from the destroyers showed they were exactly where they were supposed to be at the time. I have high confidence. Between your unsubstantiated fears and my rigorous statistical analysis, I'll take my numbers every time.
While Skippy was talking, I momentarily took my eyes away from the countdown timer on the display.
That's great, Skip. And 68 seconds mark, Skippy shouted excitedly. Detecting a gamma ray burst, exactly where it is supposed to be, and way more accurate a jump than the stupid lizards could have done on their own. Also, yes, detecting a reactor, missiles and jump drive coils exploding. The battlecruiser is gone. And yes, detecting secondary explosions.
Give me a minute. There is a whole lot of noise in the sensor data.
Yes. Yes. Successful. 100%. Both destroyers disabled. The battlecruiser jumped in slightly ahead of them. That is the best I could do with that inert lump of rock the Kristang used for a jump drive. The explosion caused severe damage to the forward section of both destroyer hulls.
Excellent. I breathed a sigh of relief. Is it safe for us to jump in?
Best we wait another 79 seconds for the debris cloud to clear the area. Otherwise, we might get whacked by something moving at high speed. Those destroyers are not going anywhere, Joe. Don't worry about that.
Got it. Program a jump for us, please, Skippy.
Pilot, I addressed Chen in the left-hand seat. Engage jump in 79 seconds.
Joe, Skippy said, I have to admit that was a clever and inventive plan. In my research, I was unable to see any way we could take out all three ships. Now I know the factor that I was missing from my calculations. It did not occur to me to use one enemy ship as a weapon against the other enemy ships.
That was clever. Especially for, you know, a monkey.
I couldn't help chuckling.
Skippy, I assume you meant that as a compliment somehow, and since you suck at giving compliments, I will say thank you. We monkeys don't have big claws or sharp teeth, and we can't fly, and we're not particularly big or strong. We rely on being clever.
Man, don't get used to it, Joe. You are, after all, only monkeys.
This is Hostile Galaxy. Every spacefaring species out there has genetically or cybernetically enhanced intelligence, or both.
Like the Theranin, you mean?
Exactly.
Yeah, I said, tapping the arm of the command chair.
It was the only chair aboard the Star Carrier that fit humans without adjustment. The Theranin commanders must have liked the feeling of sitting in an extra-large chair.
Yet here we monkeys are in one of their ships.
What do you think of that, Sergeant Adams?
Monkeys kick ass, sir, she grinned, and gave me an enthusiastic thumbs up.
Damn straight.
Crap, Skippy grumbled. Now you monkeys have gotten way too high an opinion of yourselves. I shouldn't have said anything.
We jumped over the two stricken destroyers. They were both tumbling end over end, completely out of control. Skippy reported there were survivors aboard both ships, survivors busy trying to stay alive, and no threat to us.
Sir, Adams asked from the CIC, shall we launch missiles?
I could see her finger expectantly poised over a button.
Those ships are still somewhat functional, Skippy, I asked, my jaw clenched. Can they manage a short jump?
Not on their own, no, or they would have jumped away by now. However, I am now activating the nanovirus to take direct control of their jump drive systems. Both ships can manage one short jump. In their current condition, I must caution you, that will be their last jump. Their jump drive coils are badly out of alignment.
Do it. I want to jump those ships into the upper atmosphere of that planet, deep enough that they can't climb out of the gravity well, high enough that the ships won't be crushed right away by the pressure. You can do that?
Yes, certainly.
The nanovirus is taking effect, he said slowly.
Can I ask why you don't simply hit them with a pair of missiles?
You can always ask, Skippy.
Two reasons.
First, we have a limited supply of missiles, and I don't want to expend ammo if we don't need to.
That makes sense. Sure. The second reason, which I suspect is more important?
The second reason, Skippy, is that I've been to Earth recently. I saw what those lizards did to my home planet, saw what they tried to do to my planet and my entire species. It's really simple, Skippy. I'm pissed, and I want the Kristang to experience the fear that humans felt. These Kristang, at least. You killed most of the Kristang on Earth before they realized what was happening. The ones that survived the initial strike huddled in their holes until you hit them with a hypersonic railgun. They were alive one moment and dead the next. When you jump these ships into the upper atmosphere, their crews will have a minute to realize what is happening as their ships plummet down towards the planet's core and are crushed by the increasing pressure. Think of this, Skippy, as my way of giving a middle finger salute to the Kristang on behalf of all the people on Earth.
Oh, he said quietly. Ready now.
Jump those ships into hell, Skippy.
Done. Enhanced image in main display.
On the display, the two destroyers flared into existence within the gas giant planet's upper atmosphere. Immediately, their hulls began glowing hot pink as they fell rapidly down, down, down toward the planet's core. Pieces began breaking off the ships, the larger pieces tumbling and spinning away. Quickly, we lost sight of the ships, even in the enhanced image, as they were swallowed up by the poisonous atmosphere. I held up my right hand and flipped the bird to the image on the display.
Adios, MFers, I said quietly.
Joe, Skippy said, you surprised me. That was spiteful of you.
Skippy, you know me as the doofus who jokes around with you.
I am that. You need to understand that is only part of who I am. Right now, first, I am a soldier. I'm going to defend my ship, my crew, and my species above all else, including getting a small measure of revenge once in a while.
Got it. Especially since you acknowledge that you are a doofus.
That remark managed to draw a smile from my lips as I watched the last pieces of the two destroyers disappear into the roiling clouds. I wouldn't have it any other way.
People, let's retrieve our landing party before some other group of assholes shows up here and spoil the party.
Major Sims, signal Captain Desai to proceed to the main site, and for Colonel Chang to get his team moving toward the evac site. They can drop communication silence. I want a status report ASAP.
The heavily encrypted tight beam transmissions would not reveal the presence of humans in the star system.
Skippy, program a jump to take us over to that moon, please.
Desai responded almost immediately after we jumped in near the moon again.
Dutchman, we are off the ground. ETA at the main site is 4 minutes, she said, which meant she was really pushing the dropship speed. We could hear the strain in her voice.
What happened up there?
A Kristang task force jumped in uninvited. Apparently the planet is a popular refueling station. They must have the only clean bathrooms in this part of the galaxy.
I find that hard to believe, sir, Desai laughed.
At the planet is a gas station? I asked, confused.
No, that any gas station has clean bathrooms.
Oh, she made me laugh. Damn, she had been trapped on the moon's surface out of communication, worried sick about the people stuck in their slowly suffocating spacesuits, and still she had the good spirits to make me laugh.
You are probably right about that, Captain, I replied.
There were 7 Kristang ships in the task force. 4 of them jumped away to hitch a ride on a Theranan star carrier.
And the rest?
Scratch 2 destroyers and 1 battlecruiser.
Roger that, Dutchman. I'd love to hear the details later. Any damage to my ship?
She understandably had referred to the Flying Dutchman as her ship. I didn't mind that at all. She had been flying the darn thing. I had only been given orders.
No damage. We didn't even fire a shot.
Wow. Now I have to hear about this.
Chapter 9
Lieutenant Colonel Chang had been even more happy to hear from us, especially from Desai. She landed the big dropship as close as possible to the entrance of the underground building where Chang and his team had spent over a day hiding, waiting for rescue or for their oxygen to run out. As soon as the dropship was secured in our landing bay, I ordered a long jump to get us far away from that star system. As a courtesy, I waited for Chang to get out of his no-doubt stinking spacesuit, take a shower, drink a half gallon of water, and grab a simple lunch before he gave me a briefing.
We're all fine now, Colonel,
he reported while eating the last spoonful of soup. Those soldiers are all admirably disciplined. When we got your signal, I ordered them to lay down, rest, and conserve oxygen, and that's what they did. No complaining, no talking. Mostly we tried to sleep a lot. We kept one person awake at all times to listen for your signal. Other than watching our oxygen gauges move toward zero and wondering what was going on upstairs, it was boring more than anything else. Your people were down in an access shaft? I asked. Yes, we found an area of the site that appeared to not have been looted. There was no sign anyone had ever been there for a long time. Thick dust on the floor. No footprints. The entrance to the area was hidden. We found it by luck. It led to an access shaft. I sent four people down it. They got to the bottom, and there was a corridor. He finished the last of his soup and pushed the bowl aside. It was a dead end. Appears to be maintenance access for the life support system. We didn't find anything useful down there. That was worth a shot. Good call, I assured him. You had no way to know we were about to have uninvited guests. Chang nodded slowly. In the future, we need to bring some sort of portable shelter that has oxygen, so we don't rely only on the suits. Agreed. We don't have anything like that aboard. We'll need to see if we can rig something up. We also, in the future, need to keep the landing party in one place with the dropship nearby. If we're gonna split up a landing party, we need multiple dropships, I concluded. That was a mild criticism for myself. A lesson learned. There were a whole lot of lessons to be learned out here, for all of us. Including Skippy. After talking to Chang, and seeing that the 11 others were doing well and eager to continue the mission, I went to my cubbyhole of an office to get started on writing up an after-action report while it was fresh in my mind. That was a waste of time, Skippy said bitterly, just as I sat down in my uncomfortable chair. All that way only to find an elder site that had already been looted. It was not a waste of time, we already discussed this, I reminded him. We proved your method of predicting unknown elder sites is correct. Yeah, except this one wasn't unknown. It was located at a freaking highway rest stop. There should have been a big glowing sign like, Big Mike's Truck Stop, low prices, great food, don't miss our elder site attraction, get a free t-shirt. Yeah, about that, Skippy. Why wasn't that moon on your list of confirmed elder sites, since everybody else in the whole galaxy knows about it? Maybe it was on my map in retrospect. That may have been a teensy-weensy screw-up on my part. Nothing worth mentioning. Nothing worth mentioning, you say? Skippy, you sent us into a star system that is a superhighway of interstellar traffic. The only way that place could have more traffic is if that elder site was giving away free beer, or whatever the Kristang drink. And you told us the place was deserted. It has an unimpressive star and no habitable planet. We also had a landing party suffocate because of your teensy-weensy screw-up. Please, indulge me. Mention it. Oh, yeah, sure. Blame me, he said defensively. I had to process exabytes of pirated data to create my map, so excuse me if the final result needed some fine-tuning. Now that I have that system as a data point, I know that Elderside was indeed on the map. It was mentioned in a side note. My assumption was that an elder site would be featured prominently in any data about a star system, and that is true about all the other sites I was looking at. This particular site is a side note precisely because it is so well known. Now that I know how such places are tagged in databases, I have identified 6 other similar sites, none of which are on our target list. More importantly, I have confirmed that the other unknown potential elder sites on our list truly are not known to other spacefaring species. Unless an elder site is known and isn't in any database you have access to, because the species that knows about it wants to keep it secret. That is always a possibility, Joe, he said glumly. Nothing I can do about that. You're right that it was not a waste of time. It was very disappointing. Now I have to wait again while we travel through empty space. I tried to cheer him up. Hey, you have been waiting a long time. What's another couple days? The next target is 10 days from here. That's more than a couple days, Joe. Less than 2 weeks. I tried to be cheery about it. 2 weeks in a barrel of monkeys, he said. Somebody please shoot me. Skippy was wrong. There was something we could do to avoid jumping into star systems that had permanently or frequently an alien presence.
From now on, I determined the Flower would be jumping in first to recon the place before we jumped the Dutchman in and launched a landing party. According to Skippy, sending our captured Kristang frigate in was a waste of effort. That ship's sensors were so pitifully inadequate that it could barely find a planet. I disagreed and figured he was exaggerating. When we were near the second target, we held the Dutchman at the edge of the star system, and Colonel Chang took the Flower in. He was gone a total of 12 hours. 12 hours that were nerve-wracking hours for me. The Flower jumped back exactly on time, and Chang excitedly reported what they had found. Or what they had not found. In terms of finding Skippy's magical radio, the second of Skippy's potential elder sites was another disappointment. In terms of sparking the interest of Skippy and our science team, of the entire merry band of pirates, it was a big score, a home run, a touchdown, or in soccer it would be a goal! The star, if you could call it that, was another dim red dwarf, a type of star I was getting jaded about already. There was no sign this star system had ever been visited by an intelligent species other than the Elders. The place was so boring and ordinary, there was no reason for anyone to be here, unless they thought they'd find an Elder site like we had. We found an Elder site on a small, airless moon orbiting a gas giant, right where Skippy thought it would be. From what we could tell, no one had found this site before us. No one had stripped it of valuables. The site had lain untouched for millions of years. What was left of the site, anyway? What Skippy found intriguing, mostly because he didn't understand it, was that the center of the site had disappeared, been scooped out millions of years ago. Scooped out surgically. Where the center of the site used to be, where all the important elder facilities were, was an almost perfect half-circle, gouged out of the moon. Over the eons, the edges of the circle had crumbled somewhat, and the bowl had small craters scarring its bottom from later meteor impacts. Even to my unscientific eyes, something strange had happened here. Skippy took an unusually long time processing the sensor data. "We should go down there anyway. I want to get samples," he finally said, after what for him must have been a lifetime of analysis. "There may be something useful in the outbuildings. I doubt it, but since we're here, we should check it out." "Joe, I do not understand what happened here. Or I do understand what happened here. I don't understand why. This is Elder technology. They created a spherical field that moved everything inside that field into another space-time. This is somewhat advanced technology, very energy-intensive, even for the Elders. Why they would have done this to one of their own facilities, I have no idea. We need answers. I need answers." This time I went down to the moon in the dropship, and Chang remained aboard the Dutchman. With me were the French team, because they had missed out, if you could call it that, on landing at the first Elder site. Giraud got the honor of first boot on the ground. I was right behind him, walking gingerly in the 1/9 gravity of the small moon, taking care with every step not to launch myself 100 feet off the surface. Between the low gravity and the boosted power of the armor suit, that would have been all too easy to do. The suits had settings for low gravity, preventing an unwary, foolish, inexperienced, or merely stupid wearer from doing anything that might be fatal. Those settings could be overridden in combat. Like all the other soldiers, I was eager to test a suit in simulated combat, especially in low gravity. We poked around the site for a couple of hours, looking into mostly empty structures, and didn't find anything useful. Naturally, I couldn't resist going right up to the edge of the perfect half-sphere that had been scooped out of the moon. The lip of the sphere had crumbled somewhat over the eons, although in some places, where the sphere had cut through hard rock, the edge was still well-defined. Standing there, listening to the gentle hissing of air in my stolen alien spacesuit, looking up at the vastness of star-spangled pitch-black space above, then down at the chilling mystery of the half-sphere of moon that had been sent into another space-time, I felt small. Small, insignificant. Utterly unimportant to the cold universe. I felt more than ever that humans had no place out here among the stars, so far from home. All of our problems, our hopes, our dreams, our fears of being conquered, enslaved, or wiped out by a technologically superior species, none of that meant anything to the ancient, unfeeling universe. With a shudder, I stepped back from the lip of the sphere and turned to walk back to the dropship. To my right, a group of French paratroopers were standing at the lip of the sphere, getting their pictures taken.
after one or two serious poses appropriate for the significance of the sight that was showing off for the camera, doing handstands, forming a pyramid with one soldier on the shoulders of two others. Seeing that made me smile. Screw the universe. The universe didn't care about us humans. It didn't need to. We could manage fine on our own, and even have a bit of fun doing it. We were going to be all right if we had each other. Relenting to pressure from the science team, who had mostly been stuck on the ship, I let a half dozen of them go down to the surface, accompanied by Indian paratroopers. When the scientists concluded with bitter disappointment after several hours that there was nothing of value or even interest at the site, they came back to the Dutchman. I ordered course set for the next target, and we jumped away. The next day, I made the mistake of saying hello to people as I came into the gym. All I wanted to do was run on the treadmill to warm up before running down the ship's long spine. One of our SEALs took my greeting as an invitation to talk, and he hopped on the adjacent treadmill for what I quickly learned was an uncomfortable conversation. Cutting short my warm-up, I wiped my face with a towel. "I will talk to Skippy about it," I assured him. "I appreciate it, sir," he said, and sped up his treadmill as I walked out the door. I ran a series of hard sprints and thought about how to raise the subject while I cooled down on the walk back to the front of the ship. "Hey, Skippy," I called out to him once I was alone in my cabin. "Hey is for horses." "Very funny. I have a request. Some of the crew are not happy about you calling us monkeys. It's hard to explain. It's a religious thing. They don't like the idea of humans evolving from monkeys." "Oh, sure, no problemo, Joe." Wow. His simple reply surprised me. I had expected a big argument from him. "Great. Thank you, Skippy," I said with great relief. Damn, I wish everything was that easy. "We'll cross that bridge when we come to it," he said simply. "What? I didn't use that expression correctly?"
Depends what you meant," I said carefully.
"That expression means you won't have to worry about whatever it is until it happens," I explained. "People are already unhappy, so we've crossed that bridge. You see?" "Oh, I meant that I'll worry about it when you evolve beyond monkeys."
"What?"
"From my viewpoint, monkeys and humans are identical, so if any evolution went on, I ain't seeing it. You generally don't fling your poop at each other like monkeys do. A point in our favor.
Monkeys don't shoot each other. Advantage monkeys."
"Crap. All right, can you do me a favor and stop calling us monkeys anyway?"
"But monkey is such a funny word, Joe."
"Granted.
Monkey, 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 monkey."
"Stop it! I can create a subroutine to say monkey until the end of time, if you like. Monkey, monkey, monkey."
"Shut up already!"
"We're done talking, then. That would be a great yeah." "I should have known better. We should do this less often.
You brought it up.
As you say, I am a dumb monkey. I'll remind you of that the next time you ask me for something stupid. That shouldn't take long." Rather than being alone in my office, I took my iPad to the galley for a cup of coffee. For me, not for the iPad. Desai was there, looking at something on her own tablet. She gestured me to sit with her. This was the first time we'd had some one-on-one time since I couldn't remember. Maybe ever.
"Colonel, sit down, please," she said with a welcoming smile.
"Captain, how are your trainees doing?" She took a sip of tea before answering.
"As well as can realistically be expected. Skippy is a tough instructor. He has no patience, and his social skills are non-existent."
"What? I am shocked," I grinned.
"Right,"
she smiled.
"It was bad before, when the trainees were only learning the absolute basics of flying the ships in peacetime. Now we're into what Skippy calls space combat maneuvers, and that is all new to me also. It's blowing my mind. I hate to say this, sir, but I may already be too old to learn flying all over again."
"Space combat maneuvers?" I had no idea what she was talking about. She nodded.
"On Earth, pilots go to air combat school for BFM, basic fighter maneuvers. That teaches you how to turn, to climb, mostly how to manage energy in combat flying."
"Manage energy?" I asked, baffled. "You mean fuel?"
"No," she laughed. "For fighter aircraft, energy means airspeed and the ability to gain airspeed. For instance, Some fighters are fast in a straight line, but if they make a tight turn, they bleed off a lot of kinetic energy and slow down too much, and it takes a long time for them to regain airspeed. While they're slow, they're vulnerable. Vulnerable in air combat means dead. I'm sure she was dumbing down her explanation by a factor of 10 for me. It may be more. SCM, Space Combat Maneuvers, is completely different. There's no aerodynamics to take into account. It's about moving the ship to avoid being where the enemy thinks you are, so when they target you and fire a maser or particle beam at you, by the time the beam arrives, you're not there.
A maser beam that moves at the speed of light.
Close enough, she said.
And you're supposed to move the ship before a beam moving at the speed of light hits us? That was blowing my mind also. Isn't that like dodging a bullet?
Sort of. At the distances where most space combat happens, it takes several seconds or even minutes for a beam bolt to travel to an enemy ship. When an enemy ship shoots at us, we can't even simply fire back down the inbound beam path, because while the bolt is traveling, the enemy ship has also moved.
Damn, this is complicated.
Desai nodded. So far we've been concentrating only on the basics of flying the ship. Going into combat is an order of magnitude more complex. I'm supposed to be training the other pilots, and I still don't grasp some of the concepts. This is going to be a very difficult month.
When I got back to my office, I put aside routine reports for something much more important. Skippy, teach me about space combat maneuvers.
What? Space combat maneuvers?
Oh, sure, but hey, let's start with something easier, like monkey-level theoretical physics. How about this? The Casimir effect hypothetically allows the negative energy density to support an Einstein-Rosen bridge, also called a wormhole.
Skippy, I'm serious. There is no way my tiny brain can grasp everything our pilots need to know.
Man, you're making this too easy to insult.
But as commander of the ship, I need to know the principles of SCM. The strategic level, not the advanced tactical understanding our pilots need. I need, and any command duty officer needs, enough situational awareness to make decisions. What do I need to know?
Wow. Yeah, great. Thanks. Is that all you want?
Start small and work your way up, all right?
How about this? How can one ship ever hit another ship? Even speed of light weapons are too slow. Ships move out of the way while a particle beam is traveling. You told me about how ships use sensor fields to detect and target other ships.
What I don't get is, can't ships just jump away whenever they're in danger?
Oh boy, this is not going to be easy. I'll begin at the potty training level, and we'll work our way up to Barney style if your brain hasn't exploded by then.
Fair enough.
And that's what he did.
Man, I had a lot of dangerously bogus assumptions that Skippy straightened out for me.
First, I had been assuming that when a ship jumped away from a battle, it was safely out of the fight. There was no way for an enemy ship to follow it. No way for the enemy to know where the ship had jumped to. Sure, if a ship micro-jumped only a few light minutes away, then shortly the enemy ship would detect the gamma ray burst from the other end of the jump, because those gamma rays traveled at the speed of light. Otherwise, I thought that if a ship jumped a light hour or more away, it was effectively gone, safely away. Man, was I wrong about that.
Skippy explained, the way jumps work is that a ship opens a temporary wormhole at the place it wants to jump to. The far end of the wormhole opens first, and then the wormhole projects itself back to where the ship is and pulls the ship through. The reason ships come out the far end of a wormhole a fraction of a picosecond before they enter the wormhole is because of the tiny time lag between when the far end of the wormhole is created and when the near end reaches back to the ship.
Got that?
If you don't feel bad. It took me a couple of times for it to sink in.
Opening a wormhole that is big enough to squeeze a ship through is something the universe and our space-time doesn't like. Even after the ship goes through and the wormhole shuts down, it doesn't completely close behind the ship right away. Ripples bounce from one end to the other, from the violence of space-time being ripped apart and being slammed closed again. Enemy ships can tell from these space-time ripples emanating from the near end of the wormhole remnant where the far end of the wormhole is. The ripples fade rapidly, so an enemy ship needs to act quickly in order to pursue a ship that jumps away. And Skippy said there are ways to fool pursuing ships by altering the resonance of the ripples. This technique is only minimally effective,
because pursuing ships have ways to eliminate the noise and analyze the original ripples, measures, and countermeasures. So, jumping away provides only temporary safety for a ship. A ship has to hope its jump engine capacitors have a larger charge than pursuing ships. If a ship only has enough charge for a micro jump, it will soon have enemy ships on top of it with no way to get away. In that case, a ship has to fight in normal space while its jump engines recharge. Of course, a higher-tech species ship can almost always jump beyond the range of lower-tech ships. Even though a Kristang ship may be able to tell where a Theranan ship jumped to, it would take the Kristang ship multiple jumps to get there. By that time, the Theranan ship would have recharged, jumped far away, and the wormhole collapse ripples would have faded so much the Kristang couldn't follow. Usually. All the talk about jumping away assumes a ship is able to jump away, because enemy ships can project a damping field that envelops a ship trying to jump away and prevents a wormhole from forming correctly. If a ship caught in a damping field tries to jump, it could rupture its jump drive coils, even tear itself apart. In normal long-distance space combat, ships rely on two types of weapons, missiles and directed energy weapons like particle beams. Railguns, while they sound impressive, are too slow for most space combat, except when ships are near the gravity well of a planet and have limited space for maneuvering. Missiles carry greater destructive power. A single direct hit by a missile could take a ship out of combat. Warships are protected by defensive energy shields that can defuse direct energy beams and block missiles. The problem with missiles is that even though missiles are stealthed, they are easily detected by a ship's sensor field. And then the ship's defensive directed energy systems like masers can destroy the incoming missile. In actual combat, an attacking ship uses its energy beams to degrade an enemy ship's shields and confuse its sensors to provide a weak spot for missiles to sneak through. The whole thing made my head hurt, and it gave me a different perspective on what a ship commander needed to think about in action. I asked Skippy to set up a dumbed-down space combat maneuver training for everyone who sat in the command chair, including simulations. How do pilots remember all this stuff? I asked. Not only remember, they had to understand the concepts, internalize it, until it became instinct. They're smarter than you, to put it bluntly. The pilots aboard this ship are among the elite of your species. I frowned. And I'm a grunt who got lucky. What the hell was I doing in command of pilots and special forces soldiers who were clearly in every way better than me? You have your own talents, Joe, I've told you that. You went from being a sergeant to prisoner of the Ruhar to shutting down a wormhole and freeing your home planet from the Kristang. How many of our elite new crew can say that? What-ifs are fine when you're talking over a few beers, but you can't argue with success. Thank you, Skippy. You're welcome. Now, if you'll excuse me, I need to find a fork. Not sure I had heard him correctly, I asked. A fork? Why do you need a fork? Dumbing myself down enough to explain things to you contaminated my substrate beyond repair. I'm hoping if I stab my processing nodes enough times with a fork, I can kill the part where those memories are stored.
Yuck.
Hearing a tiny bit about space combat maneuvers from Skippy got me interested enough that I asked Desai to forward the full SCM training package to me. Reading the first section made my head hurt, and made me realize that before I could think about maneuvering the ship in combat, I needed to understand how ships operated. I approached our chief pilot again in the galley while she was sipping tea and reading something on a tablet during her off-duty time. That morning, I'd seen Desai running on a treadmill in the gym and decided not to bother her then. She'd been listening to music. By unspoken agreement, time in the gym was private time unless people wanted to be social. Good afternoon, Captain, I said, pouring myself a half cup of coffee. In the kitchen, two French paratroopers were working on baking something for dinner. They nodded to me briefly, then went back to kneading dough. Something they had baking in the oven smelled delicious. And the idea of splitting cooking duties between national teams rather than bringing professional cooks aboard had been partly my idea. I'd been trying to reduce the number of people we put at risk on the mission, and UNEF had wanted to maximize our combat power. It had been an experiment. Would pilots, scientists, and spec ops soldiers resent taking time off from training to cook and clean? To my great relief, the answer was a resounding no. First, the hotshot pilots and spec ops troops were all super competitive.
No team wanted to let their nation down by serving food that was anything but the absolute best. And second, the teams treated their assigned day in the galley as a mentally challenging, fun day off.